It is 6 p.m. A brief look at the forecast before we go to It's the Economy. We're going to have a 50% chance of thunderstorms along the Front Range tonight. That will be clearing up around midnight. It will continue to be mostly cloudy, and the low temperatures tonight will fall into the 50s. Another chance of thunderstorms tomorrow, 30% on Friday into Friday evening, and then clearing up on Sunday. Beautiful sunny skies, high temperatures in the low 80s. Another bit of a chance for rain later on Saturday afternoon, clearing with low temperatures in the low 50s, and sunny again on Sunday, high 86. And good evening and welcome to It's the Economy for this Thursday, September 2nd, 2021. I'm your host this evening, Liz Lane. Our interview tonight is with Professor Ole Mold. He's a lecturer in human geography at Royal Holloway, University of London. His work focuses on issues of urban activism, social theory, and creative resistance. He regularly calls for global work strikes and blogs about this issue at his blog, tacity.co.uk. He's also the curator of the website Palliative Capitalism. And his brand new book out by Polity Press, coming out this week, is entitled Seven Ethics Against Capitalism. And we go to that interview right now. Professor Ole Mold, University of London. Let's just start with sort of the bottom line first premise of your work, which is that capitalism is on life support and has to be replaced with something. So I'll just let you go from there and we'll get into the seven ethics and then your reimagination of what New Year's Eve 2029 is going to look like, which is fascinating. So off we go on why capitalism is on life support and how these seven ethics that are actively resisting and pushing back against capitalism, how you're, in your view, they are the path to a more sustainable future.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think the premise of the book is essentially that you're right, capitalism is not fit for purpose, essentially. I think that we've had centuries of it now, and the last few decades of it, I guess pretty much since the financial crash, you could argue, it's accelerated into some sort of weird, fascistic, very hyper-nationalistic form of capitalism whereby you have once bastions of sort of liberal democracy like the United States, like Great Britain, Brazil, the sort of powerhouses of the 20th century have become these places whereby they're shutting down their borders, they're implementing extremely authoritarian policies. Like in Britain, for example, we've got the Kill the Bill protests going on because there's this really draconian criminalization of trespass and all sorts of things. And of course, we had Trump in America. We've got Bolsonaro in Brazil, very kind of problematic leaders, let's say. And it's predicated upon this idea that, which essentially at its most basic, this idea that we must grow. Everything has to be predicated on this idea of economic growth, that you are not a decent company, you're not a decent country, you're not a decent person, unless you are somehow growing your productivity or growing what you have. Now, in a bountiful world, that growth protocol, I guess, is okay, if that's the right word, or at least it's hidden. Whereas in the 21st century, in 2021, we are quite obviously not in a bountiful world. The world is quite clearly, we are digging more stuff out of the ground and it's killing us, essentially. We have climate catastrophe. We've seen it hit us pretty badly in 2021 with the wildfires in California. The year before that, we had wildfires in Australia and in Brazil, the burning of the Amazon rainforest.
Siberia, Sweden.
Well, absolutely, Siberia. And it's just, it's, you know, the flooding in, there are, I've seen videos of flooding in Sierra Leone, in Pakistan, in Frankfurt in Germany, various parts of Germany, Belgium. It's just unsustainable. And the science is undeniable that it's caused by rapacious capitalism, this desire to extract fossil fuels out of the ground and burn them to make consumer products, to make more stuff for us to consume, which we just throw away and thereby adding to the problem. So, you know, a lot of the sort of the mainstream, or at least the consensus of environmental scientists, their activists with Greta Thunberg, everyone else, are arguing that we need system change. Tinkering around the edges is just not going to cut it. Green capitalism, sustainable growth, it's just not going to work. We need wholesale, radical system change. Some people call it degrowth. Some people have called it the circular economy. All these come into it, and they're all options to explore. For my view, I think that there's the idea of the commons has existed for millennia, and it's an idea right under our nose, and it's an idea that could be implemented in a much more kind of progressive, futuristic, civilized way to create a world which is very much looks very, very different to the capitalist world we live in, but it's actually far more sustainable, it's far more just, it's far more equal, and actually gives everyone the opportunity to enjoy what we already enjoy, things like, you know, brilliant cultural artifacts, a good quality of life for most people anyway, in the global north. But it can spread that around, you know, but without digging into the ground and burning all these fossil fuels and creating what is essentially a cliff face for the human race. Because let's not beat ourselves. The planet is fine. The planet will survive. The planet has gone through a lot worse in the history of Earth's existence. You know, it's gone through ice ages and all sorts of things like meteor strikes that killed off the dinosaurs. The planet will survive. It's us that won't, you know. Saving the planet is kind of the wrong word. It's saving us, because the planet will be fine. Give it another million years or so, the planet will go back to an equilibrium, because that's what it does. It's us. So this is, let's not be around this. This is, you know, omnicide, right? This is the kind of, this is the survival of our species we're talking about, not the planet. The planet will be fine. So, you know, that's kind of what the commons is trying to do, to save ourselves as a species, which kind of sounds very grand, but I guess that's a
very urgent. It sounds very urgent too. So yes. The idea of a planetary, it's a planetary commons. So yes. it supersedes cultural, racial, language differences. It's a human community that you are envisioning, correct?
That's right. Yes. It's very different to the idea of a global or an international. I think that's a key difference to make. I mean, there's a feminist scholar, Garrity Spivak, who talks a lot about the idea of globality being the kind of homogenous, or globalization, let's say, this idea that there's a homogenous idea which imprints itself around the world. You know, this idea that capitalism is a global phenomena and that everything has to kind of become that. So air trade, financial institutions, everything becomes that. Whereas her arguments are that a planetary is very different. It's a connected tissue of humanity, which embraces the differences that we have, but actually recognizes those differences as material. So what one community does, say in the global north, in America, or in Europe, has material consequences with a society, say in Latin America or in the global south, more broadly, through extraction of fossil fuels or through whatever it might be, through opening a new mine to
labor. You
know, well, absolutely, and labor. So a planetary concept does away with this idea of the globe as a totality. Spivak is very clear. She sort of says, look, we need to do away with this idea of the globe as a totalizing vision. We need to embrace difference. We need to understand that we are connected and everything has a consequence, cause and effect, right across the globe, because we're connected. And the virus, you know, the pandemic has shown this, right? Bruno Latour talks about how the virus has indicated we are a viral community. It's viralized our world. You know, I'm talking to you over a computer network, like we're in the same room. And so it's, you know, it allows us to become connected in many ways that we didn't think of before. So that difference that we kind of embody should be celebrated. So we are a planetary species. We just need the planetary society to reflect that.
Well, and it strikes me, and you mentioned this frequently in your book, Seven Ethics Against Capitalism, that the task of creating a new system to actually replace capitalism is even more daunting now in this age of hyper individuality that we live in, that technology has ushered in, where we are so siloed individually in the news that we read, in the people that we are in touch with, in our own digital space that we create. So putting the idea of the commons at the center of global reform and a global response to hypercapitalism and a climate catastrophe seems like an extremely tall order at any time in history, but particularly so now when we are so individualized. Mm. So if you can address that a little bit.
Yeah, of course. I think you make some really interesting points there and some really good ones. I think the issue is with the ethics that I've outlined. I mean, I didn't really arrive at them arbitrarily. They're kind of quite a careful consideration based on some of the research I've done over the last decade or so, maybe more. But you're right. I think individually, the ethics kind of act as a way of combating the injustices of capitalism. So if we are mutual, if we try to encourage ourselves to be mutual, to decenter ourselves, to become anti-individualistic, which, like you say, is a tall order, but actually, it's actually fairly natural. I mean, look at the pandemic again, like the mutual aid things that have sprung up. The first instance that many people thought when we all locked down was like, is my neighbor going to be able to get their food or their medicine? How is my mum going to be? Do I need to call my mum? We didn't really, I mean, maybe this is patchy perhaps, but I don't think we really slipped into the dystopian views that often Hollywood likes to say, that when there's a global pandemic, we all sit behind a door with our shotgun ready to defend our land. I think we became very empathetic species. And I think that's to me is quite heartening, that actually this individualism is impinged upon us. And it's just sort of, this is how you need to act in order to grow or to progress. And actually we're not like that. We are quite empathetic beings. As I explain in the first ethic, like with that site, you know, dabbling in sort of psychological studies and neuroscience and sort of microbiology as well, to a certain extent, that we are actually a connected species, whether we like it or not. And we have the capacity to be empathetic. I think capitalism is this sort of unnatural state, if that makes sense. I think that we are kind of conditioned to be social creatures. You know, we all descended from the same kind of primordial soup, right? We are all connected in some way. So I think we just need to encourage that. We need to sort of put that into our governments, into our policies, into our society. Now, that's obviously the difficult bit. But again, I'm hopeful, because look at the youth movements of today. I mean, you go on Twitter or you go on the news, it's all doom and gloom, but it often, those are the people that have the kind of the voices. I've done a lot of research recently around mutual aid. I've been a project around it here in the UK. And it's been really heartening to see how people are coming together, you know, really sort of making themselves uncomfortable. Like you say, learning about different cultures, learning how Black people have been repressed, learning how disabled people really struggle to get around the city, learning what everyday sexism is, to create a fairer system and a fairer way of distributing the wealth that particular person or that particular community has gathered. So, yeah, it's like I say, I think that the unnatural things that are going on are the systems of governance, which are sort of pinning us down in these individual, like almost like a divide and conquer. Do you know what I mean? They kind of keep us all siloed and say, well, you know, you've got to look to yourself to make sure you do this and that and the other. Whereas actually, you know, in a system that's the coronavirus has kind of shown, we can be empathetic beings and quite easily, actually. So, yeah, so that's kind of where the ethics come from. So there's lots of them. So individually, they kind of attack capitalism. But I think together, if you kind of put them all together, it's almost like, I don't want to use the word blueprint, but I like to think of it as a kind of crutch or a trellis to kind of encourage the commons to diffuse into the capitalist society. And the idea being that people might say, well, actually, it's a much better way of doing things. Let's not worry about capitalism. And it just kind of withers by itself and dies away.
I want to remind listeners that you are listening to It's the Economy on KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. My guest this evening is Professor Ollie Mould. He is a lecturer at Royal Holloway at the University of London. And his new book, just out this coming week, is called Seven Ethics Against Capitalism. And I'll just list them right now. They are mutualism, transmaterialism, minoritarianism, decomplication, slowness, failure, and love. I think we've covered mutualism a little bit, just talking about this idea of empathy, that the COVID pandemic, in a way, removed blinders from many people's eyes and really exposed others' vulnerabilities as well as our own, and the possibility that it offered because it did disrupt all of our daily practices, our social constructs, how we work, how we live, who we spend time with. I really appreciated the reference in your book to Aaron Doherty Roy, the author who has been a guest on many programs on KGNU over the years, but she regards the pandemic as a portal through which we could imagine a new future that previously really was unimaginable because of the overlay of industrialization and capitalism and the movement of everything. The ethic of slowness is just a direct medication to the ever-growing pace. And people talk about that a lot, reflecting on life before the pandemic and life after, and that with all the difficulty that came with the pandemic, the ability that people had to just have a few minutes to think about their life, their work, what they were doing. I mean, everybody described previously life on a conveyor belt globally. And of course, the lower one goes in terms of labor and lack of control over one's time and output, those people were ever, you know, the idea of productivity, being productive, using your time. These ideas that seem to be so pivotal to capitalism and how we function were blown up overnight. You know, productivity, getting to work, getting things done was completely replaced by other concerns. So the pandemic, in a way, as Aaron Doherty Roy said, it has been a portal to imagine a different world. But really, I mean, you will recall that early in the months of the pandemic, people were reporting all over the world natural phenomena that they hadn't been able to observe in previous, you know, years. They could see a horizon they couldn't see before. There were more fish in the water near them. And I think many of us are less driving, less moving around. I think, you know, many of us feel, while the pandemic might not actually be over, that we are closer to the way the world used to be before the pandemic than the way we are now. So I think that's a great way to bring in the ethic of transmaterialism into the conversation. And then I think next, the toughest one, and it may be the most important one, is minoritarian. Can you say that word for me?
It's a different minoritarianism.
Minoritarianism.
Essentially, I made up the word because I wanted each ethic title to have one word, and or to be one word, and there wasn't really a word. It's an idea that is heavily influenced by Deleuze and Guattari's work. Deleuze and Guattari are two French kind of continental philosophers who lived sort of back into the 80s and 90s. Well, most of their work was kind of in the sort of 70s, 80s, and 90s. And they had this idea called becoming minor. And a lot of their work is around how, capitalism creates a majority world, not in terms of numbers, not in terms of, you know, sheer number of people, but in terms of where kind of the wealth flows and where the centrality of the power and all those decisions are made. And their argument is that, a more just world, if that's the right kind of phraseology, requires us to become minor, to not embody these subjects, but in my view anyway, to understand them and to empathize with them, which is why it links to this idea of mutualism, to be empathetic to people who just don't have the same kind of experiences as a white guy does in you know, where I live in the southeast of England, which is one of the richest parts of the world, right? So it's about listening, it's about understanding and doing everything you can to to raise those voices up. I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement has, I don't think it's any coincidence that it coincided with the pandemic. I think that, like I said, the pandemic being a kind of portal, as Roy suggests, you know, I have a lot of sympathy with that. I kind of think of it as an event where it kind of breaks down the sort of way we understand pretty much everything. And the pandemic, it ruptured how we thought about the world, not only on a kind of conscious level, but I think also on an unconscious level. And so Black Lives Matter, in the way that it did with the murder of George Floyd, it kind of added to that sense of injustice that the coronavirus was exposing, and that ability or inability that we've had over the years to connect with the material world around us. And so I think that the Black Lives Matter movement wasn't an accident, and it really, and part of what they say is, you as kind of white allies need to raise up black voices. And that to me is minoritarian in thinking. And in the same way, they say, well, then that spawned the Black Lives Trans movement and the Black Lives Deaf movement. And it added these kinds of intersectional ways of thinking. And it's all about sort of understanding how these modes of oppression work and trying to break them down, because they're each different, but they each require their own sets of tools, if you like, or weaponry to try and disarm those kind of sets of oppression. So that's what minoritarianism is, essentially. It's just trying to make the majority, so whiteness, if you like, which capitalism is kind of built upon, right, with colonialism at its heart, trying to completely disarm that and understand how it affects black people's lives and women's lives and disabled people's lives and everything else. So that's monetarianism. What was the other one?
And I just want to note too that, you know, your idea of a planetary commons, which is the goal here, is to have a concept and a mutual way of thinking about all of our destinies. But, you know, you say that to get there, a planetary commons has to reckon with the inequality that has been created and perpetrated by centuries of capitalist development. So it's not enough to simply pivot away from capitalism. We have to reckon with, deal with, and repair the harm that capitalism and the hyperactivity of 21st century capitalism has wreaked on our fellow citizens, with whom which we want to be in a common with. We can't be there with them if we don't understand their experience.
Yes, absolutely. No, that's absolutely right. It's a much better way of saying it. And I think that, you know, you can't just sort of wipe the slate clean and start again, you know, because the same systems are in place. So we'll just replicate it a few years down the line, which is why things like reparations are really important, or, you know, on a global scale, because over centuries, the global north has developed over the sort of ill-gotten gains from the global south. Through massive asset stripping of Africa and everything else. So reparations, I think, would be a massively important part of a global commons, because it's an attempt to undo that. In the same way that, you know, if in my experience, for example, in an academic department, you know, if there are a number of black colleagues and it requires the department to sort of, you know, change the way that they operate to make sure that those black people aren't oppressed by their students or whatever it is, or particular modes of whiteness in the existing university. You try and change university structure to help them. That happens on a global scale. You have to sort of ratchet that up. The global north countries have to acknowledge their complicity in the years of plunder of the global south and make amends to do it. You know, you can't just sort of cut ties and go, there you are, we're sorry, but on you go. You know, they need the sort of redistribution of the wealth, essentially, which is a very kind of socialist idea, but I guess that's kind of part of it. So that's what's really important.
Well, it can be called redistribution, or it can just be called paying you back from what we took.
Well, absolutely. You can call it whatever you like. It needs to happen. You know what I mean? So it's, you know, this is what needs to happen. So, yeah, so it's a really important part of it. And I think... So that's why the commons, it requires a sort of this planetary mode, because it will require the everyday, like you say, the kind of changing how we think about the world and how we think about our everyday interactions with people around us, but also how institutions and how governments and states relate to one another. So, that's why you can't sort of pin it to a particular scale.
I want to talk about transmaterialism as well, which is a hugely important concept if one is trying to be anti-capitalist. So if you would talk about transmaterialism and its role in this development of of a new planetary commons that would replace capitalism, that would be great. Mm-hmm. And I guess the other part of that too is trying to decouple individual action, right? If we individually stop, you know, replacing things, if we fix things more, you know, the right to repair movement is very much a part of that. But is that really going to be enough given where we are environmentally? Should we, lots of people talk about that individuals, all the actions that thoughtful, concerned individuals are taking to reduce their own carbon footprint does not itself, even if millions and tens of millions of us do it, is not going to do it if corporations aren't called upon to do the same thing. So if you could talk about transmaterialism individually and then in this corporate structure that we're in, that would be very useful too. Thank you.
Yes, you're right. I think that there's a really interesting debate to be had there. I was just chatting to someone the other day actually about, oh, well, you know, what's the point of recycling? Because it, you know, it doesn't matter because is it 70% of the carbon emissions come from only 100 companies? But I think that's the wrong way to think about it because you're falling into the same trap of individualism. Because if I recycle, if I buy an electric car, or if I, you know, try and be as transmaterial as I can, that's not just me that's doing that. You know, you don't see it, but it has an effect. You know, someone might see that and, you know, the conversations you have over the years, other people might take it up. And it bleeds into to the way you conduct yourself. And also then perhaps the way you might become an activist. You might sort of start to talk to your MP. You might start to talk to your member of Congress. You might try and change the system. And if more and more people are doing it, it puts pressure on it. Now, that's not to say that, throwing away or not throwing away plastic straws is going to save the world. It clearly isn't. And we do need to put massive amounts of pressure on these 100 companies and on the governments. But I think you can't do that without then living the life that it kind of entails. So, you know, I think it's a bit of a moot point when people say, oh, yeah, well, you know, because you see politicians, a US senator, I forget who it was, but during climate change in the wildfires, I think they were saying, oh, yeah, but China this, China that. Yes, but if the US and the UK and everyone else was to decarbonize to net zero, China would, you know, be under a lot of pressure to do it as well. And, you know, there would be a lot of, you'd have a lot of kind of kudos to say that actually you need to do it as well if everyone else is doing it. So it's not a kind of zero-sum game here. What you do has an effect. You might not see it and it might not happen for another couple, you know, instantaneously, but it has an effect. So transmaterialism is really, really at its heart is leveling up the human and the non-human world. It's about understanding that the world around us is not a material just to consume and throw away. Be that animals, be that, you know, the land, the air, whatever it is, or even the plastic stuff that we consume. It's you have to understand that it's a kind of a living part of the world, which requires, you to understand how the life cycle of it. So it's just so veganism is really, I think, an important one. And I have to say, I'm not a vegan. I like cheese too much, but veganism as a philosophy allows us to really understand. Actually, you are exploiting by eating meat. You are engaging in a particular kind of exploitation. Now that might be fine for people, and you know that's okay. But to understand that it has a consequence, and the cattle industry, for example, has a huge amount of carbon emissions, and the agriculture industry. That's not to say we don't all have to stop eating meat. It's to understand that it has a consequence, and we need to change the system of agriculture so that it reduces the carbon emissions. And if that means only eating meat once every 2 weeks or something, then so be it. That's a policy that will have to be implemented by a government to say, right, meat Fridays or something. That's the only day you can eat meat. If that's what needs to be done, that's what needs to be done. So, and the right to repair is another one. I know Elizabeth Warren's been quite keen on that. In fact, it started in the States in 2012, I believe, the farmers wanting to repair their tractors, I think it was. And again, very, very good kind of policy, which is forcing corporations to act. It's forcing corporations to change how they do it. So like I say, it might be small, it might be individual, but it has a consequence, cause and effect, and it all adds up, and it adds pressure. And yes, we're not going to change China's mind overnight, but you know, if enough of us do it, then you never know, we might.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to It's the Economy on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host this evening, Liz Lane, and my guest this hour is Ollie Mould, Professor of Human Geography at Royal Holloway, the University of London. His work focuses on issues of urban activism. He's the curator of Palliative Capitalism, which is an image website that is extremely arresting. No words, just pictures of hypercapitalism in action. And he also blogs at tacity.co.uk. His brand new book just out this month is called Seven Ethics Against Capitalism. So we've talked about mutualism, we've talked about transmaterialism, minoritarianism, and next is decodification. And let's talk about that a little bit. That's really an interesting one. The ranking of everything, putting numbers, data, stats on everything. You say statistics and data is the language of capitalism. So talk about that a little bit and how we can decodify ourselves.
Yeah, well, it is, isn't it? I mean, you know, everything has to be ranked. Everything requires a 5-star rating. Everything, you know, we all have smartwatches these days, which tell you how many steps we've made. And if you haven't done 10,000 steps, then what are you doing? So, numbers are the language of capitalism because they make it easier to, I guess,
measure progress, measure growth, measure progress.
Measure growth. It makes it easier to sort of strip it of any kind of ethical kind of content, that kind of emotive, effective.
No qualitative characteristics, just the number, quantity.
Absolutely. I think it always struck me that and I'll tell you exactly how this ethic kind of came about. I was chatting to a friend of mine who ran a children's youth club back 10, 12 years ago. Now, it was before my first child was born, and she's 10. So, and it was closed down in the town where I lived. And she was upset. She was completely distraught. And I said, well, look, this is bearing in mind, this is in the sort of a couple of years after the UK government implemented austerity, which is where they cut a lot of the sort of social services and community things. So this youth club was closed. And we were talking about it, and she said, look, Ollie, I wasn't able to show that the children who came to my club were just getting a bit of respite from the domestic abuse they suffered at home. I wasn't able to quantify it. I wasn't able to put a number on how happy they felt, or I wasn't able to kind of measure their quality of life or the better, just because they were able to come out of their home for 2 hours and not get the crap kicked out of them by their drunk dad. So it shut down. And from then on, I thought, do you know what? These numbers are harmful. They are hurtful. And it's not the numbers in themselves. It's their implementation to create a system which doesn't recognize anything else. So it's about kind of the whole world is ranked, and we see it all the time. With universities, they are ranked, and that funding is linked to it. I've done some work around urban rankings and how the quality of life of cities gets banded about, and what it does. Cities end up gaming the system and implementing policies and spending money purely to satisfy a particular quality of life ranking. So, for example, like how the access to green space, or which is not a bad thing, but it's gamed, the number of streetlights, or how they spend loads of money on these amazingly wonderful bright streetlights, when there's the homeless person who sits under them might still not have somewhere to sleep and might actually get worse sleep because they're being lit up all night. So it's a useless system because it doesn't get to the heart of what the common world is, which is quite uncodified and quite qualitative, as you say, quite affective. It doesn't have a number. It can't be measured. It's just felt, which is like empathy. Like, we all understand when someone's having a good time or when someone's happy. You can't put a number on it. My God, how happy are you today? Oh, I'm 6 out of 10. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. So But we know when we're happy and we know when we're not. And I numbers remove that from the world. And so to regain that, we need to decodify. So we need to elevate qualitative understandings of the world into our policy decision-making. That's kind of what decodification is. And it means not wearing a smartwatch.
Well, you also note, though, that some of the data, some of the codification that is imposed on us can actually be useful, though, like in the way that apps can tell protesters doing a Black Lives Matter protest where the police checkpoints are, that there is a way to use data for the planetary commons, right? Like Wikipedia is another example of that, right?
Exactly. So I guess the point, the difference there is that data or the use of an app is not necessarily a codified use of it. You know, you can use an app to find out where your fellow protesters are, or to find out where the police are going to strike next at a riot or whatever it is, or you can have community pollution sensors which are based around that. That's not necessarily a codification of the world. What that is using technology and data to help us better understand the sort of tacit nature of the world. And so I would draw a distinction between the data and codification. Yes, the use of data by corporations codifies the world, right? Facebook, Amazon, all that lot, they see us as numbers, and you know, they sort of see us as, you know, Facebook is very ultimate kind of tool in this. It sees us as a very, very pigeonhole kind of demographic which they can advertise to. But that data isn't necessarily a bad thing if it's used in the right way. And obviously, one of the things I would suggest is that a public kind of use of that, like Wikipedia, is a public, essentially, it's a public good. And it's become the most important information source in the world. And so, and that's all because it's, loads and loads and loads and loads of editors and contributors all working in real time. If Facebook or Amazon worked in that way, or Uber, like, that would be brilliant. I think a public Amazon that was run in a democratic way would be brilliant. And I think that you can already sort of see some of the movements of that in London, in particular, in Uber. They had a big legal case with Transport for London, and there was calls for Transport for London, which is essentially, I mean, it's a kind of a private public-y kind of thing, but they run the trains and the buses kind of pretty much publicly, and they're quite cheap. And so there were calls for TfL to take on Uber, to have a kind of Uber-style service in the... Okay. In a thing, so I think that's probably not a bad idea. It's when corporations obviously have the bottom line and profit at their heart, wield data to codify us to make us better consumers. If that's
correct.
The word.
Correct.
So that's kind of what codification is. So data itself is not a problem. I think that's important, and it's important because you can have qualitative data, quantitative data.
If we're going to decodify ourselves, or if our ethics is one of decodification, do we try to hack our brains to not care about things anymore? Right? I mean, how do we do that?
It's a tough one. You're right. I mean, I think that's not a bad way of putting it. I mean, I think that there's a certain desire within us, I think, to understand something quickly, right? Our brains are sort of relatively limited in that respect. If I didn't go into the science of it, but our eyes and our ears and our brains, they tend to reduce data quite sort of significantly just so to process it. So I think if you broaden that out, if you're thinking about a city, which is what my kind of area of research, to understand a city, what the essence of London is, if you gave me some numbers, that might make it easier for me to understand what London is. So I don't think, I think it's a kind of natural state for us because we're quite limited sort of beings. So that numbers help us to understand that thing. So it is difficult, but I think that, like I say, it's not necessarily the pure act of, datifying everything or making it a number. It's kind of how that is then used. And if it preps capitalism's appropriation of us, then I think that's when the problem arises. You know, that understanding the world, numbers help us to understand the world. And that's an important part of kind of the commons, because, you know, we're going to need to kind of understand things quite quickly. But if that number is then kind of pinned upon something and then used to sort of package it or brand it or sell it or create this kind of system whereby your funding is dependent upon it, that's the issue. I think, you know, is it Mary Engel's work is really important here, because she looks at some of the domestic abuse in women in the global south, and she argues that the UN use unqualitative data or something, data that hasn't been garnered through kind of on the ground ethnographic work, mm-hmm. and it's just not helpful at all. Whereas the data generated by people who go into these communities, understand these women's problems, and then actually create data and numbers because of that, that's a far more effective way of dealing with the problem. So that's the difference.
So slowness is the next one. There's slow food, there's slow fashion, and the slow movement has been, I've been talking to people about slow living for probably 15 years, and there's sort of a more recent angle on this, which you might have seen. It actually is called the lay down movement, that people are just lying down. This is happening in China. A work was called upon to do something more, and they just said no, they are going to lie down. A journalist who wrote this piece, a guest piece in the New York Times, talked about her own. She left a production of a National Public Radio program, and she's lying down in West Virginia, watching the world go by there. So there is this movement of not just saying we want to be slow, we want to push back against the relentless pace of capitalism, but people are actually doing it and doing the opposite. And in some way, the pandemic also ushered in an era where this is maybe marginally more, and I put this in air quotes, acceptable. So talk about slowness in the battle to develop an anti-capitalist world.
It's funny you mentioned the lying down thing. I've not seen that. I'll have to look it up. But
I'll send you the link. Yeah,
no, that'd be great. Because when I do my third year course, an undergraduate course here at Holloway, Royal Holloway, I get the students, we do a bit of sort of psychogeography, which is kind of this movement of wandering around without an aim, sort of drifting around the city. And I get them to lie down. We go to the South Bank and we lie down. And just the sheer kind of horror in the students to say, no, I just wanted to lie down, not even for very long, maybe a minute, maybe 2 minutes. And it's in the South Bank in London, which I'm not sure where, it's a very kind of carnivalesque kind of place. And so people expect people to do silly things. And some of the students, no, I'm not doing it. And it's just bizarre, like you say. And so I'll have to look that up. It's lying down is something that I've been teaching, if you like. Teaching is the wrong word, but
what
using
it. More of a pushback against capitalism.
Exactly. So that's what slowness absolutely is about. It's about just completely going against this sort of hyper-capitalism. John Crary wrote a brilliant book a few years ago called 24/7, and it's all about the kind of the speed up of capitalism and how, you know, even our sleep has kind of has to be productive. And so, you know, it's really in response to that mobility or that hypermobility of modern life. And actually, just by simply slowing down, if we slow down as a society, you know, what would happen? What would we do? You know, if we just said, you know what, we don't need, I don't need to get to work for 8:30. What, you know, just what happens if, you know, fashion trends didn't rotate every year? And the argument against that is, well, you know, we need to do it in order to compete because we need to be ahead of the game. It's like, yeah, but that's the point. If we do it collectively, then that's something that's actually much better. Kate Fletcher is an activist over here, and she pioneered the slow fashion movement. So simple things like, you know, just having one annual kind of change of trends, you know, using non-sweatshop labor to make the clothes. But it bleeds into everything else, because a lot of slow fashion, you know, they end up being sold in independent stores. They're often in some of the transition towns here in the UK, which are sort of those kind of ethical eco towns. But of course, that means it ends up being expensive, and it ends up being kind of quite elitist and middle class. So there's a playoff here. You have to kind of try and keep it grounded and keep it kind of in the, because it ends up being fast fashion becomes very so much cheaper that the majority of working class people or the urban poor end up buying that stuff. So it's about kind of subsidizing slow fashion outlets so it remains cheap or it remains affordable in the same way that it trans materials, in the same way that homegrown foods, for example, or you know, vegetables from the local market aren't more expensive than ones that have been flown over from Chile. So it's about having policies and government action in place which makes it affordable, keeps it available for everybody. And so slowness is essentially about, yeah, just kind of understanding that we require times just to be. Like this other meditation industry is built around, and it's an industry which obviously exploits people and exploits us, and a lot of it is just rubbish, right? But there's a kernel of truth to all this stuff, which is that meditation, and you know, if you're a religious person, you can call it prayer or whatever it is. If you're a runner, then runner's high. There's, we all have a time where we are kind of, where we need to focus, we need to dwell and just simply try and shut out the world. And that can be scaled up. You can scale that up to an industry. You can scale that up. Like, you know, I think, is it Nike? I saw someone having like, they're having a mental health week or something, a whole week off recently. I don't know. I'm
great.
Well, I saw on the BBC News website, maybe I didn't actually look at it, but because it's probably just a sort of gimmick as it usually is. But, you know, this is how these things start. And then obviously over a couple of years, they become more involved. The 4-day working week, there's a big movement here in the UK to have a, you know, a 4-day working week. That is a kind of ethic of slowness because it's like, actually.
Well, I'd say that you need space, that if you are going to have mutualism, transmaterialism, minoritarianism, and decodification, you need space and time to contemplate those things and to give them space to work their way into the system.
Exactly.
I'll just also note your predicate that capitalism's growth is predicated on the idea of desire and want. And if we are, you know, and this is really part about decodification too, that if we can train ourselves out of this ranking system, of this productivity system, if we can remove ourselves from it, have less FOMO, less fear of missing out, and not and not fall into the 4-time-a-year fashion trends, and we need this, we want more. You know, it's hard, you know, when you're living in this way and advertising is constantly playing on our AI knows we do want, right? Because we've been looking at it online. But it is, I mean, a lot of this work really does start internally with ourselves. Is that right?
I think so. It doesn't, it certainly can't get much bigger without it. I think that, you know, social media is obviously a real problem because it ratchets up the cycle of fashion, like the memified
and comparisons,
kind of.
And it's all about comparison too.
Yeah,
one of your colleagues wrote the book Happiness a number of years ago, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and the whole thing is to do with comparison. Everyone was fine with their salary until they found out what the next person was making, and then they weren't so fine with it. So, okay, in the couple minutes we have left, and I really do want to get to your ending here, but we'll just. Give some, we'll touch on failure and love. And then I would love for you to share what you imagined you would be celebrating and applauding on New Year's Eve 2029. Yeah. So briefly, Professor Ole Mold will talk about failure and love as ethics against capitalism.
Yeah, they're kind of intertwined insofar as that it's about understanding that, in terms of failure, understanding that not winning is not necessarily a bad thing. It sounds obvious, but and there's a lot of these gurus that sort of say, well, if you fail the first time, it just means you're going to succeed the second time. It's like, well, that's just recasting failure as another means to success. Failing ethically, I mean, this is where the work of Jack Halberstam is really, really insightful here. And if you haven't read their book, I really encourage you to go and do The Queer Art of Failure, where they argue, it's called The Queer Art of Failure.
The Queer Art of
Failure.
Of failure, okay.
Yeah. And it really argues that, well, there's a sense that capitalism dictates what success is. And so if you don't reach that, then you are a failure and you have to kind of, so it plays into that growth protocol. But ultimately, actually, what failure is just landing on a different way of being. You're just kind of, you know, you're not failing, you're just being different. And I think that, you know, we have to sort of recalibrate this. And, you know, I talk about, again, ratcheting that up to a kind of slightly bigger level. You look at things like eco squats and some of the, I talk about the Paris Commune, which was considered a failure insofar as that it didn't stop the sort of capitalist kind of purge of Paris. But what it did was that there's lots of latent energies that have kind of gone on, and it actually creates other things down the line. And actually, if just because you've failed at your immediate goal doesn't mean that it doesn't automatically mean that it's a failure overall. And, you know, time allows us to see that. But of course, if we're not slow, we won't see it. So that they kind of link together. And in terms of love, I mean, ultimately, you know, I kind of grew up in a Christian kind of household, Christian background. And so it's very much foregrounded in a lot of the kind of gospel understandings of a selfless kind of unconditional love that, you know, it is one that in which you make yourself uncomfortable in order to make someone else comfortable. And so you give up what you have to give to someone else. So it's nothing particularly new, I guess. But what I think I have done is kind of talked about it in relation to some of the more contemporary things like Facebook, for example, which has this kind of friendship, which is nothing of the sort. And it kind of recasts the sort of philia style of love as a sort of codified relationship. So, you know, if I send a WhatsApp message to someone, and they don't respond within 5 minutes, like, oh no, they don't like me anymore. Whereas, you know, that's a condition of modern life. And it's like our friendship now is kind of calibrated on how quickly you respond to a WhatsApp message rather than, you know, how whether you help someone in need, or at least kind of that's how it's portrayed. So I go into the four different Greek understandings of love. Philia is one of them, but the one I've land on is this agape, which is the kind of, I guess, the kind of Christian tradition. This idea that you have to completely decenter yourself. And Martin Luther King advocated this sort of stuff. He was a very keen philosopher of love, as was Jacques Ellul, who was a kind of French anti-Nazi kind of resistance person. And so there's lots of these kind of kernels of, I call it Christianicist thought, which is about kind of sort of saying, well, look, capitalism is the root of evil, to a certain extent, and therefore a love helps to kind of negate that, because it's completely anti everything capitalism is pro. And as I say in the book, love powers, it gives an energy to all the different kinds of ethics which have gone before it. So, yeah, that's kind of what I mean by love.
So, wow, a tall order, but it looks like there are, again, the pandemic seems to have at least created space for us to truly reimagine modern, you know, post-20th century life in a way that we wouldn't have before. And you know, talking about imagining the future, you do just that. You take these ideas and look at their origin. And again, as I mentioned, lots of queer and feminist theorists influenced you, and European influence as well. But let's go to New Year's Eve 2029. It's toward the end of your book, The Seven Ethics Against Capitalism. And you say there are going to be plenty of things to be happy about in this coming year. So let's, I will say that the president is... AOC, she's beginning her second term in this. The Green New Deal was spearheaded by her, and it wasn't just a recalibration of existing industrial production systems. It was a wholesale change in how we extracted resources out of the natural world around us, utilizing the trillions of dollars leveraged in the groundbreaking Robin Hood tax that targeted financial transactions first, but soon scooped up 90% of all inherited wealth transfers. The U.S. was able to offer every citizen a basic income, universal health care, and the ability to 3D print their home. Wow.
Well, yes, it's a nice thought, isn't it? I mean, The background to this is that I like my science fiction films and books and everything else, but a lot of it's very dystopian, and I enjoy writing dystopia, and I think my students like hearing about my dystopian ideas. So I wanted to try and think about what it might be like as a sort of utopian, and I think that, you know, I wanted this to be a hopeful book, so I wanted to try and write you know, if it was a kind of utopian world, what would that look like? And so, but what I've also tried to do is take kernels of truth from the existing world and amplify that. How, what would it look like if they kind of work their way through over the next 10 years? And so, yeah, the Green New Deal is the obvious one, right? The Green New Deal, I think, is a must. It might have to look a bit different to what it is at the moment. I've not been keeping tabs with it most recently, but as it was spearheaded by AOC and Bernie Sanders back in a couple of years ago, I think it's a no. And something has to be, we have a similar thing here in Europe, which we should really be putting forward. But actually, if you look at what's going on in the world at the moment, actually in South America, there's a lot of the sort of more progressive in terms of like some of the socialist governments, if you like, and socialist candidates are really coming through. I think it's in Chile. Forgive me, but there was a student protester who's now like leading the polls of something. So I saw on Twitter anyway. But South America, I think, is a crucible for this sort of stuff, which is why I've kind of said that actually maybe a lot of the most progressive forms of government, even to an extent that maybe we don't need a government at all, right?
Right.
Citizens assemblies have been mooted. I mean, we have a citizens assembly here for climate action in the UK. A devolved government, like people talk about devolution has been really important, and where the federal government just acts as just merely as a sort of broker of meetings more than anything else, and just kind of just becomes a sort of an administrator of the money rather than anything more decision making. So what would a kind of a really radical devolution of that look like? And I think that in South America, that's where it would start, which is why I sort of say President Arca of Bolivia might kind of be the first one to try and devolve a national government. Because actually, there's a city in Mexico called Chiran, which I write about a lot, and that hasn't got a government. It doesn't involve itself in presidential elections. It has a government by sortition, you know, where they just draw lots.
Wow.
And it's been doing that since 2011, and it's been a very successful city. They've managed to increase the quality of life, to use figures. They've increased their literacy rates and everything else. So it does happen. So basically, I've tried to sort of show what that movement.
It's not a utopia. What you describe is really a reimagined world based on planetary commons ideas, but these ideas are already in play and in place, and perhaps gaining speed. The $15 an hour wage was something that was completely anathema 4 years ago. Socialism, no way.
Yeah.
We're going to do that, corporate profits. And of course, again, the pandemic created space for, you know, people needed to pay their workers better and or else they weren't coming back to work. A couple other things. Really interesting that there's a United Federation of Europe. Annalena Baerbock, she heads the Green Party in Germany. She spearheaded a move to make all workers members of their company's profit schemes. Again, this is an idea that Elizabeth Warren has advocated here, a financial transaction tax, a four-day work week, recalibration of the food industry, which you cite here in your description of 2029 coming in, that was one of the most significant acts that halted runaway carbon emissions, which we know the agricultural industry is responsible for huge amounts of that. President AOC required community gardens to be set up for every new neighborhood built and the growing of food from electricity to be taught to every school child, which means that we now have a generation of people who eat on average 75% of their diet from local neighborhood gardens, thus having slow food, local food, you don't have to go across the country. So just some beautiful, beautiful implementation of ideas that so many people feel are just no-brainers right now.
Well, that's it. And, you know, I think that it's a very nice of you to say. I mean, like you said, they're just sort of nice ideas, but they're not utopian. They're not pie in the sky. They are happening. And if you join them up, in a mutual way, perhaps, let's say, then I think that the world would be a far better place than it is in the moment. And, to bring it back to capitalism is very good at telling us that these things just aren't worth their while. They're too expensive. Well, you can't do this, you can't do that. Well, they're not. I'm sorry, they're not. They're very, very cost effective and actually would make the world an incredibly better place, just not for the small 0.1% of people who currently benefit from the system. So, yes, it's basically a kind of an augmentation of the present to sort of show what, and taking all the good bits out of it and show what it would be like.
And that it's possible, that all of it is possible.
Yeah. So, I think what's interesting, sorry, just very quickly, is that the sort of the state level is really important here. The level of, which is why I wanted to write that, because it was like, what does the state do? Like the countries, the politics, the governments. Because the planetary commons, it sounds very anarchistic and sort of anti-state, but I think the state is going to be
Welcome to Highway 322. It's Ginger here with you on this kind of cool morning. We've got, or cool evening. We've got some thunderstorms in the forecast for the next couple of days, and fall is in the air. You can feel those shorter days, longer nights. Kind of nice to have some cool weather. We really had some heavy-duty heat and smoke, and it's a nice change. You're listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins online at afterfm.com. Ginger here with you for the next hour with American folk music. Some of you know I had an accident about 7 weeks ago, and I just got my neck brace off today, and it turned out that they were very mild fractures, so not much to worry about, no ramifications from the fall. I'm holding steady and going strong. So that's good news. Good news for me. Hope it's good news for you, too. We're going to start off with a little Nancy Griffith. Some of you know that my brother died in Vietnam in 1969, and Nancy Griffith became enamored with Vietnam and took up the cause of landmines in Vietnam and had a big heart for the people there. This song is about Vietnam, and she... it's very poignant for me. She mentions the year 1969, which is the year that my brother died. And she says, "Where were you in the streets of Saigon?" And if you listen to it with that in mind, I think it'll touch you too.
Vietnam that I dreamed, the place you wore your life fatigue.